superior to the one that we had.
To make a long story short, he negotiated a successful joint venture with Bob, and hence Oxoring was formed. But when they really got into that, they were working in a completely different area. They were a process to make styrene, propylene oxide, and there was no place to put the styrene or sell the styrene because it was huge quantities were made. And we were working on a process to make tertiary butyl alcohol and propylene oxide. They had done virtually no work on that at all. And the only reasoning I came to was that Bob was basically afraid to take the risk without somebody else reinforcing the fact that the work was good, the technology was good, and that it would work. I would say that the things that characterize me as being different, maybe, and which I can attribute some success to, was I was never afraid to take risks. And then secondly, a fair confidence that, based on my judgment was good enough, and I had enough confidence in myself that if I took the risk, that it would work. The second thing I think was the ability to galvanize a team of people to work together and to accomplish a goal. And we had very effective teams of people, and we developed an enormous loyalty. Many of those same people today are people who are still in contact with me and who still help me and want to help me do put together the new companies or whatever I'm doing. So you have to generate a sense of excitement, provide leadership, a sense of confidence in what you're doing. And I can honestly say that in all the years that I presented new projects to the corporation, I don't remember ever being turned down. And they were as diverse as pacemakers and other things. There's a classic story I like to tell about the pacemaker.
Pacemakers.
Yeah, we were in the pacemaker business. And when I came here in 76, I had nuclear operations, I had commercial development, engineering, and research reporting. And in the nuclear operations, they had developed under government contract a nuclear pacemaker. It lasted 25 years. In those days, pacemakers had to be changed frequently. We implanted one of those nuclear pacemakers in Bob Anderson's mother, by the way. But subsequent to that, we invented the lithium battery, which is now, you know, every quartz watch in the world and so forth. It was a major development. When I say we, I mean our company. I had nothing to do with the invention. And we were able to put the lithium battery into pacemakers. And to make a long story short, I remember going to Los Angeles and making a presentation asking for $5 million for the initial plant and then another $5 million. And Bob Anderson said, "Great, you know, let's do it." And I was picking up the slides afterwards, and in the room behind the boardroom, and I heard the vice chairman, Louis Davis, saying, "God darn, Bob, you encourage these fools with these crazy ideas. What the hell do you know that we know about pacemakers? You just blew $5 million. He said, "Louis," he said, "I don't care whether it works or not." He said, "But I'm not going to kill the entrepreneurial spirit in this company. He came in here, told us he had an invention, and he wanted to make a business out of it. I say, yes." He said, "And that's what's going to make this company great." And we did build a business there, and we had to get out because of the ethics involved. And I use this in my speeches on leadership as two of the great dilemmas that I had in establishing what it is you want to do and what it is you believe in. The first was pacemaker we had out there was implanted in a baby by a doctor, and it wasn't supposed to be. But it failed, and the doctor wrote me a letter and said it failed suddenly and without warning. And he felt that the mechanism in the pacemaker was defective. So I got everybody together, the scientists and so forth, and they said, look, it's a statistically insignificant event. We have 10,000 of these things out of there. This is the first failure. We don't think the doctor knows what he's talking about and so forth. And we discussed it for some time, and finally I said to the people, I said, statistically insignificant, quantify that for me. How many failures do we have to be statistically significant? They said 10 or 12, whatever the number was. And so I looked up and I said to them, well, you mean you want to kill 10 more people before we recall these pacemakers? And I said, can anybody here live with the idea of 10 more people dying because we have a defective pacemaker? So they said, well, now hold on there, you know, if you have a recall, it's going to cost $2 million. And then you got all these old people with these pacemakers in, having to go in for treatment, you may kill 10 people just doing that. And I said, well, that's interesting, and I guess it's possible, but at least I will have felt that I did the right thing. Issue a recall. And so then I picked up the phone, I called Bill Kuchnick, who was the president at the time, and I said, Bill, I said, tomorrow in the Wall Street Journal, you're going to read about the fact that we've recalled 10,000 pacemakers. It's going to cost the company $2 million, and there was no reason to do it, because we're well below the FDA requirements of failures and so forth. But I found it morally objectionable to continue with the thought that we might have a defective product and a number of people could die suddenly. He said, well, did I ever ask you to do anything that you didn't agree with from a moral standpoint? I said, no. He said, well, then why did you call? So we had the recall. The second issue on the pacemakers was, and this is what really put us out of business. One night, the top cardiologists were the ones who you had to convince you had a good pacemaker. So one night they asked me, now this was a small business for us. They asked me to have dinner with the top cardiologist in Northern Jersey. And he was in Philadelphia, and we had arranged that after, while dessert was being served, the guys would get up and go to the bathroom, and I'd find out why this guy wasn't buying. And so that happened, and I said to him, I said, Doctor, I said, look, we've had you down deep sea fishing in Florida. We had you out to Las Vegas for a convention. You're having dinner with me. I said, now, I'm the president of this company. It's a small business for us. I said, but I can't go back to the office tomorrow unless I sell you a pacemaker. I said, now I'll get down on my knees here if you'll sign for a pacemaker. I need at least one pacemaker from you. Why aren't you buying our pacemakers? You know they're the best. He said, well, he said, I keep telling you people. He said, I'd be happy to buy from you if you would exhibit in my medical products show. Every year I have a medical products show. I said, well, we exhibit in a lot of medical products show. He said, yes, but you usually pay $5,000 for a booth space. In my shows, you pay $50,000. So I said, well, doctor, I said, I understand completely now. And I said, I'm pleased to know that our people didn't refuse to do that. And I said, doctor, I can tell you this. You ain't ever going to see me again, and I don't care whether you ever buy a pacemaker. So we found at that time that Medtronic and other people were kickbacks, payoffs, and it was just not a business that we could stay in without compromising our principles. And so we decided to sell out, exit. We did. There have been several instances of that. I gave an example of just recently at Freedom in Germany, where we got out of a certain business. Cost us very dearly. Student's reaction was interesting. One young man said, who are you to impose your morals and principles and standards for the U.S. on another culture in another place. And I said to him, well, I said, you know, it's a decision that is an individual decision that you have to make. I said, I'll tell you how bad it is. I said, in Germany, I said, it's perfectly legal to make kickbacks and payoffs. That's why you see the Germans getting all those contracts in China. And I said, and I said, the United States law is ambiguous. It says that you can't give kickbacks and payoffs to government officials. But it doesn't say you can't bribe the head of the laboratory to approve your product and disapprove the others. I said, so, you know, it's an interesting challenge. If that's the way you want to do business, people do business that way. I said, but on the other hand, you're never quite sure where the money's going to wind up. And one thing I found is, it's very lonely in jail, and the facilities are not very nice. And I'd rather sleep at night rather than worry about it. But you're going to have to make that decision yourself. And so it's kind of interesting. We went out of that business. We went out of the municipal water treating business. We had set up 6 or 8 plants around the country to sell chemicals to most municipal systems. Kickbacks and payoffs involved, and we wouldn't do that. So we closed the plants down and went out. And so, you know, how you conduct yourself in business, and the same thing that carry over the way you treat people, the way you treat customers, and how you conduct yourself. I used to say when I was president of Orica Chemical, my life is an open book. The company is open to anybody who wants to come in and look at it. If we're doing anything wrong, we don't know about it, and as soon as we find out about it, we'll correct it. And God knows, we certainly aren't trying to do anything that's improper. That's the way we ran the company. So, I wish I could say that about every business I've come in contact with, but it's just not true. You see a lot of things, especially when you go out and buy companies, that just are not right. And that's no way to conduct a business. So, lots of different things, and you do have a lot of challenges from an integrity standpoint that you face when you are a member of a top company. And it's interesting; most of them you don't find. You know, everybody says, well, you audit, and the audit to tell you a thing. Most of the times, the thief or the criminal is probably brighter than the auditor, because the auditor is usually an inexperienced guy that some accounting firm puts on it. And most of the time, you find things out from your employees. And the tone that you set and the behavior that you exhibit very much influence what people believe. An example, I got a letter from a lady one time saying, my dear Mr. Sorgenti, my husband tells me you're a very deeply religious man, so forth, and I can't understand why your company asks him to do things that he finds morally objectionable. He comes home and he cries every night because he knows he has been doing things that are improper. Well, of course, you know, we've audited that function. It was a company out in the desert in California. It was called Desert Seed Company. It's a Mexican immigrant. And, of course, you know, I get the people in, and I say, you go out now, you talk to that woman, and you find out what the hell she's talking about. And, the audits are clean. I'm saying, I can't believe this. Sure enough, they go out there and talk to a woman. They're supposed to get Mexican government approval to ship seeds into Mexico. They're falsifying their approval sheets. They're doing other things. The president is stealing from the company. None of it turned up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm saying, but this woman, recognizing the kind of tone I try to set, can't understand why this is happening. And I can't tell you how many of those kinds of letters I've received over the years where people are, order this have turned up nothing, and from that standpoint. So this little discussion began by saying, well, what is it that made you successful? Well, the ability to invent and create something, then carry it through to completion, but also the ability to cause people to work together, and it's always been fascinating, interesting.
Hal, thank you. Let's stop there. We're at, I think, a good
Let's go grab
break, and we've at least got into the story.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.